see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. Much more than I never knew, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Community in Depth. We had to play that whole song because it indeed is a wonderful world when we have our next guest in studio with us. And we want to welcome today Mr. Lou Lindy. And Mr. Lindy is here today to we're just going to get caught up on the air, talk about your life, your wonderful work that you've done, your wonderful family. Great to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I feel like I have not seen you forever, and then I actually ran into you not too long ago, but you are always out and about, aren't you? You don't miss a lot.
Move around a lot, yeah.
You do. You do. Now, I, of course, know you for 1,000 years ago, for you are the dad of one of my dear, dear friends, Paul, and I remember you when I was younger. You, of course, were one of the founders of Hastings Family Service.
Yes, I was, yeah.
It's pretty impressive.
47 years ago.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And I mentioned Paul. Tell us about your other kids, please.
Paul? Well, Paul, of course, he's a psychiatrist in San Francisco. My oldest son, Ken, is retired. He lives in San Antonio. And then my daughter, Kay, is a retired dental hygienist. She lives in South Carolina. And then it's Rick, the flight attendant with Delta Airlines, and then Sarah is a high school counselor in Richfield.
Lots of accomplishments, yeah, in your family. So let's talk about your life, because you had a great career, and you were not born and raised in Hastings.
No, I was born and raised in a little town called Cyrus, Minnesota. It's out in west central Minnesota on the prairies. It's it's 9 miles from Morris, Minnesota.
Okay.
Where the University of Minnesota Morris is. And then finished high school. My family is kind of interesting, too, to brag about them a little bit. My father was a country doctor, and he delivered over 600 babies in his career. And my mother was a school teacher, and she was interesting because during 1919 and 1920, she worked in Washington, D.C. in the civil service, and she was one of these suffragettes. So when you see a picture of these women in her white dresses marching down the street, she was in that group marching. So it was, and then she was first woman to be elected on the school board in my hometown.
When you think about the time of that, because that would have been what year?
27 was when the women got the right to vote.
So when your mom was in Washington, D.C., or when she was even as a school teacher, that was way ahead of her time, wasn't she?
Well, kind of. She taught school. She was well educated, and she was bilingual, Norwegian and English. She could pick up on Norwegian literature and translate it right on the spot. Of course, I think women are better at linguistics than men are, but. I can tell some stories about it.
Well, oh, dear. So you left, you graduated, and then you came to the Twin City area?
No, well, I went in the military. I was in the Air Force for 3 years and worked as a weather observer. And then the wonderful thing about my military service from 46 to 49 is that I had the GI Bill. So I went to college and 2 years of night law school on a GI Bill, which was very beneficial because nowadays people, they go to spend a lot of money. Some people can't afford to go to college. So then I finished college, and then I went to the St. Paul College of Law for 2 years. It's a night school. And then I had a chance to get the scholarship in social work, and I went to Indiana University for 2 years and got a master's degree in social work. Finished there in 1957, and the interesting thing about that is that the scholarship it paid everything. Now, that doesn't happen nowadays where you get a scholarship like that. But one of the conditions was that I had to spend 2 years working in a state mental hospital. And at that time, Minnesota had about 6 or 7 mental hospitals, so I had quite a choice. But I picked Hastings because I wanted to be close to the cities, then I wanted to finish up my legal training. So then I went back to law school, and I graduated in 1960. And, of course, I enjoyed working at the Hastings State Hospital. They had 1,000 patients at that time. I was a social worker for the geriatric unit, and 1/3 of the patients were Alzheimer's or dementia patients. And, of course, what happened in those days is pretty much true today. They were basically warehoused. Even today, there isn't an awful lot that can be done for a person with Alzheimer's. But I enjoyed it.
So as a social worker, what did you do to help them, or what were your duties?
Well, my main job was that when a person, in those days, people would be committed, you know, mentally ill. And then my job, basic job, was to meet with a family, get a social history. And, of course, in those days, it was kind of interesting. Well, it's even true nowadays. A person felt real guilty about committing their loved one. So we spent an hour together. And the first half hour, I was had to deal with their guilt. See, the thing about social work training, you're dealing with emotions and social things too. And then at the last half hour, I would gather a social history. And then if we placed patients, you know, back in the community, which I was part of that, making arrangements for them to return home. And then I, you know, interacted with the patients. I used to have a few patients in treatment. So it was a very interesting situation. They had about 6 or 7 doctors there. It's kind of interesting. The doctor I worked with was the only doctor that hadn't gone through chemical dependency treatment.
Really?
And in those days, doctors, when they graduated from medical school, if they got into, you know, it was tough for them. They couldn't make it. But the doctor, Dr. Rosen, was the superintendent there, and he made arrangements to take these people under his wing. And they were, you know, the fact that they had chemical dependency problems, they still were good doctors, you know. And so it was interesting. And then I moved on. Then I went to work for the Department of Public Welfare. One time I was a supervisor of adoptions and foster care in Minnesota. And I, from 1960, though, until 61, or till 66, I was with an agency in Minneapolis called Correctional Service of Minnesota, and I went to the prison, you know, prison reformatory, gave legal advice to inmates, we got not only to criminal situations, but we got in situations, domestic situations, divorce and all that. And of course, in those days, even today, 95% of the people go to prison, plead guilty. So once they plead guilty, they've gone through that process. There isn't much chance of their getting out of it. Well, then in 1971, I went on the parole board, Minnesota, the adult parole board. I was a chair, and we sat in panels of three, and the other four members were lay people or, you know, weren't temporary. And that was kind of interesting, too, because everybody has a little different idea about crime.
Mm-hmm.
And then so we had to figure out how much time we had the authority to release people, keep, you know, that sort of thing. And, of course, then they abolished the parole board in 1982.
So at that time, when you, quote-unquote, came up for parole, that meant they met with people like
a
you?
A panel.
A panel.
And
okay.
We had the authority over them to decide whether they stayed or whether they were disparoled. And it was interesting because the people I with were lay people. It was, you know, different ideas about when you talk about punishment.
So when you say lay people, what were some of their occupations?
Well, in other words, they weren't professional. I was a professional, you know.
Right.
But they were business people. One was an ex-high school principal. One was Ralph Tejas. He was ex-warden of Stillwater Prison. One of the interesting things, I'm going to tell a little story about that. This Ralph Tejas, ex-warden, you know, we'd be interviewing an inmate, and then he was real tough on the inmate. He'd really make him go through the crime again and really chewed him out. And then we had this other Howard Rundquist, who was an ex-high school principal, and he was kind of soft and mellow, and he'd look at the inmate across the table and say, "Now, how's your wife, John, and how are those children?" That sort of thing. He was real mellow, except that when the man left the room and then we were there to make the decision about what we're going to do with this person, this the warden,
he was
big-hearted. He was soft. And the ex-principal, he was a tough one. But it was kind of interesting how you see those emotions go through.
And you were in the middle.
I had to kind of.
So how many people come up for parole a year, or how many at that time did?
Now, of course, we have 9,000 people in prison. In those days, we had about 900 people in prison. But
that's it?
Yeah. And, of course, we met quite frequently.
So the parole changed, though, you mentioned. The system changed.
They abolished the parole board.
How is it now? What is
parole?
Okay,
now the sentences are set in a court. The parole board used to determine how long a person stayed in prison. Now the judge sentences, and basically, just to give you a kind of a rough idea, let's say a person gets a sentence of 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
They have to serve two-thirds of that, and then they'll be released on supervised release for the last 2 years. With the parole board, it's like rolling the dice. We could do anything we wanted to. Well, that's kind of crude to say that, but we had all that authority over.
So now when you hear that somebody is up for parole, that does not happen
in
Minnesota?
No, they're not on parole. The supervised release. In other words, they've served their two-thirds of their sentence. And then once they serve the two-thirds, they're gone. They're out.
Why and two-thirds? So nobody serves a full sentence, you don't think?
Well, if they get on, if they violate the supervised release, then, of course, they're brought back to prison again. So they can serve the full sentence, but.
And now there's 9,000 people in prison in Minnesota?
Something like that, yeah.
10 times.
Yeah.
So crime has gone up that much?
You know, that's a long, involved subject, and I haven't followed that close, but. And, of course, our population is growing all the time. There's more crime. It's a long story. We could spend a couple hours talking about that whole thing. But so then the parole board was abolished in 1982. And then I went out to Stillwater Prison as kind of a middle manager type person. It was kind of interesting. I did a variety of things. And then I retired from that, from the state in 91. And that's when I started doing pro bono work with the Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. In the first 3 or 4 years, I went to Red Wing. They were part of the Red Wing. And I kind of enjoyed that, driving down to Red Wing, and I had cases down there. And I did family law, divorce work. This is all legal services, pro bono, in Red Wing, Goodhue County.
Okay.
Yeah, it didn't have anything to do with the institution down there.
So getting back to the Hastings State Hospital, That is the campus right now of where the Veterans Home is located. Yeah. And how long ago did the state hospital close?
I think it was about 1980. Been close.
And where do folks that need that kind of service, where do they go now?
They're on the a lot of those people are homeless on the streets. I hate to say that because we closed a lot of our hospitals. And then the idea is that when you phase out the state hospitals, then the idea is that the community, we're supposed to take care of these people. Well, the thing is,
It doesn't always work
out that way. And see, the other thing you have to, about homeless people at the state hospital with 1,000 patients, there was always a group, not a large number, but there was always a group of people that really weren't sick enough to be in the hospital, but they're too sick to be in the community. They used to have a diagnosis. This is kind of a street term, but inadequate personality. Day late and a buck short. I mean, there are people, in our society is pretty high speed, high pressure now. A lot of people can't make it. They just don't have the ability. So these people wind up being homeless. And then, of course, you have the, you have the chemical dependency, and that's, there's a lot of...
A lot of reasons for mental illness. Yeah. And mental illness, I think, is the number one reason why people are homeless.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then plus, some of those people, of course, are chemically dependent, too, and mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Well, you know what? We are going to take a little break, and then we're going to continue our conversation. Our guest today is Mr. Lou Lindy, who is so fascinating to talk to because there's not a topic that we can't delve into. And I'm so glad that you're here today. So we are going to come back with part two of our interview with Lou Lindy. And you are listening to another edition of Community in Depth on AM 1460 and FM 97.7 KDWA in Hastings.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They're like much more. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.